Welcome to episode 85 of the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, the show designed to help you reduce the leverage that alcohol has in your life and your relationships. In the past few weeks, three people have arrived at the community forum looking to share their troubles with like-minded people. It's not a lot, but it's a start. And if you need to talk to someone about your problems with alcohol, then follow the link beneath this episode on the Needy Helper website. Come and join a fantastic group of people. You do not have to do this thing alone. A lot of people think that they have no way out. There is nobody to talk to. Their friends don't understand. Their partners don't understand. Nobody understands. Well, in the Needy Helper Community Forum, we understand. So get over there. Start checking in every day. Start asking for help and guidance. Start helping other people. We make a big difference in people's lives over there. So check out the Needy Helper Forum, the link you will find on the website, needyhelper.com. Now, I have a free giveaway for you before we get started. Well, sort of a free giveaway. Are you a fan of the author Stephen Pressfield? Well, if you're not, you should be. Well, I have a bunch of copies of The War of Art, Turning Pro, and The Authentic Swing to give away to people. I asked Stephen Pressfield to come on my podcast. He said, look, I don't go on podcasts. I'm a writer, but I'll send you a ton of my books. So I've got a garage full of these things, right? If you want a copy, okay, for nothing, then leave a review and a rating on iTunes. Take a screenshot of that review. Send it to me at needyhelper@gmail.com with your name and address. And the community will select a winner on a weekly basis. And we will then send you a copy of a free book. So you choose also in that email whether you want a copy of The War of Art, Turning Pro, or The Authentic Swing. Do that, you can really help me out and get a free gift at the same time. Now, on to today's guest, Justin Schanfarber. Justin is a couples counselor and author specializing in sex and relationships. His articles, featured in the Huffington Post and The Good Men Project, have been read by over 10 million people worldwide and translated into five languages. Justin's relationship book, The Reconnection Handbook for Couples, Insights and Practices for Cultivating Love, Sex, and Intimacy, Even in Difficult Times, is available on his website, where you can also download a free sample chapter, okay? But you don't need to download that sample chapter, because I've read his book. I read it in a couple of hours, and I can tell you it is one of the best books that I have ever read on relationships, and it is probably the best book that I've read in the last 6 months, okay? It is that good. If you're in a relationship or you want to get into a relationship at some point in the future, or you've just got out of a relationship and just hate people, then just get this book. It is fantastic, okay? Justin also offers an 8-week intensive relationship training course, and he also works with people one-on-one, and you can find the link to his website on our Needy Helper webpage, okay? During our conversation, we talk about the importance of accepting our partner's contradictions, the manipulative practice of gaslighting. Yes, that's a word I've never heard of before, but I come to understand that I'm a world champion at it. We talk about conflict management. We talk about the importance of women, especially, finding self-expression if they're stuck in a relationship that doesn't allow that. And we also talk about the tyranny of orgasm. And who doesn't want to listen to a podcast when we're talking about the big O, okay? Now, relationships and the way we exist within them is a critical cog in the alcohol machine. And I found this podcast to be one of the most interesting, enlightening, and illuminating conversations in the history of the podcast. I'm pretty sure once you've listened to it, that you will go and buy his book. You will hire this guy. He is he's like a relationship magician, and I really learned a lot speaking to him for a good 90 minutes. So without further ado, I'm going to shut the hell up, get your ratings and reviews and your photographs over to the Needy Helper blog so we can give you a free book. And in the meantime, I'll leave you in the capable hands of Justin Schanfarber. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. I am, of course, your host, Lee Davey. And today, my special guest is Justin Schanfarber. Did I say that right? Schanfarber?
Yeah, very, very good. Perfect.
Where is that name from? It's an unusual name for me.
Yeah, well, my grandfather was adopted, and he comes from German Jew background. Hmm. And I don't know a whole lot beyond that.
And I got to be honest, you're the first person I've ever spoken to called Justin. So that's a really pretty cool name as well. So I like it.
Thank you.
It's an alcohol addiction first, straight off the bat. I read your Reconnection Handbook, by the way. I read it the other day. I couldn't put it down, Justin. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. What has the feedback been like on that book? Because I thought it was great.
Well, I haven't had any bad feedback yet, but I think that's sort of the nature of the thing. People usually tell you when they love it and not when they hate it, I guess. But I think it strikes a chord with lots of people, and I think that's because I wrote the book directly out of the experience that I have the privilege of having, of getting to look so deeply into so many relationships and the patterns, the patterns that become apparent out of that, I start to compile, and that's essentially the book. So I think people, they may not relate to the entire thing, but there's usually something significant in there that they recognize in themselves.
I just want to apologize straight from the outset. I'm on the tail end of a cold, so I might cough a lot. I do apologize. It's interesting. I love a good relationship book, you know. I often think I love it because, you know, I often think I'm pretty crap at relationships. Maybe that's because I've been divorced. I don't know. But if you was to give me, you know, the opportunity to just achieve one thing in life, justice, I would like to be the world champion at relationships and communication. So I loved the book and I connected with everything that you wrote. I don't know if that means I'm a complete mess or what, but I did. And it started straight out of the bat when you started to talk about contradictions. And there's a quote there that you write, "When we see contradictions in our partners, we see them as problems to be solved, like broken machines." And wow, if I had a penny for every time I turn around and said to my wife that you are just a walking contradiction, and then she turns around and says, "Well, so are you." That's the first time I've seen somebody talk about it in any relationship book that I've read. Can you just talk a little bit about your thought process and what you've seen in relationships in terms of contradictions and how it plays a part in, you know, breaking relationships apart, I guess?
I think we're uncomfortable with contradiction. And for some reason, I don't know if this part of being human or it has to do with our culture. I suspect that it's at least partly a part of Western culture. You know, I have some ideas about that. And I do a lot of reading about this stuff too. So there's some evidence for that. We're uncomfortable with contradiction, and we want to solve it. And there's some part of us, probably mostly unconscious at first, until we really start to examine it, that feels anxious about contradiction. And we want to be free of that feeling of anxiety. And so we want to get rid of contradictions. There's also the self-righteous part of it, you know, and in couples, if there's a conflict pattern set up in place, then pointing out the contradictions in your partner is like a always available go-to for putting yourself in a better position. So there's kind of a competitive aspect to it. And I think it's pretty unconscious. So my purpose in writing about it was to pull it into the light of day and really meet it head on. Because I think the assumption is, even in lots of relationship books and lots of counseling practices, is that we have to somehow like compromise our way out of contradiction so everybody feels comfortable. And my approach is a little different, and it's more like, well, let's hold that contradiction, and can we make space for that contradiction in our partner, in ourself, in our relationship? Can we stretch ourselves enough to hold? One way to look at it is to hold multiple truths, multiple seemingly contradictory truths. And to me, that's a worthwhile task. And that ability is the sign of a higher level of maturity for an individual and for a relationship.
One of the things that came up for me when I was reading it was, I get very angered when I see contradictions in my wife. And then yet when she tells me that I'm being contradictory, I'll reply by saying, no, I just change my mind regularly. And
so you have a sense of humor. That's good.
Yeah. I do. I change my mind regularly. So I'll believe that it's black today. And then I'll read something and like that you've written, and I'll be like, "Oh, I never thought of it like that. I now think it's white," and that can annoy my partner a great deal. You know, it's like, "Oh, yesterday you were so sure that the world was black, and now it's white." And that is quite interesting. How I've noticed how I get annoyed with my wife about traits that she has, which I display myself and don't even realize I'm doing it. You know.
Yeah, and here you are noticing it, naming it in public. So presumably that's useful.
Yeah, it is. And reading relationship books, talking to people like yourself and being very self-reflective and mindful and having lots of arguments and conflict helps. But my main goal at the moment is to try to catch it a little bit early, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. So you mentioned contradictions, and I really touched upon it, and I thought it was very interesting. And you talked about, can instead of us trying to meddle in somebody else's contradictions or let it kind of raise the shackles, so to speak, why don't we just allow them to just exist and be okay with them and let the person be who they are and accept them for that? And you touched upon introducing the concept of paradox. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so paradox is connected to contradiction, and it also brings up another important idea of dilemma. Mm. So if we're able to circle back around to dilemma, I think that'll be illuminating.
Yeah.
So I'll if you can help steer us there, if I get off of that, that might be helpful. Mm. So paradox is like the wise relative of contradiction. Like you've probably noticed that contradiction tends to paint you into a corner, or you just kind of arrive at a dead end.
Yeah.
Paradox is like a deeper contradiction where Well, even right now, like I'm sitting, I'm kind of wrestling with trying to define paradox. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what paradox does, is it makes you sit and wrestle with something. And so when we start to work with contradictions, we start to work with welcoming them, examining them, tolerating them, then we might start to find the wisdom in those contradictions. There can be like an aha that comes out of it. Hmm. I'm having a hard time really putting my finger on it in this moment, because it's kind of esoteric, but it's also really important.
Yeah, the reason that I raised it was because it wasn't, although contradiction smacked me in the face and I really understood and got it, when I read about paradox, I found myself Googling it, and I wasn't sure it was because I hardly ever use the word paradox in my own language. But what I like about what just happened in that exchange there was the way that you had to slow down and think about it, which in itself is how you describe paradox. So if I'm in a situation with my wife, an escalating conflict situation, we'll say, and I feel she's being contradictory, my modus operandi is to jump very quickly into an accusatory kind of like posture, Whereas if I am aware of paradox, I'll hold off and I will think and consider that there could be some truth in her contradictions, and to accept that there is a reason behind why she is saying what she's saying, even if it does come off contradictory. And I think that's kind of what I got out of it. And the next time I go to tell my wife, "You were being contradictory," I think I will remember reading this passage and I will think paradox, and it will make me stop and think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for using that moment as an example. I'm glad that you picked up on that.
Hmm.
Conceptually, I sometimes think of a simple contradiction as two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And paradox is three-dimensional or multi-dimensional. So suddenly you can, if you're looking, I imagine a car crash, like playing with Hot Wheels cars down the floor, and yeah, bang, 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 right? There's your contradiction, bang, 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 bang. But suddenly with a paradox, you've got ramps.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got on ramps and turn. I don't know if you ever played with Hot Wheels when you were a kid.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And so there's three dimension. There's three dimensions to the thing. Some doors open, and if we're open to paradox, then, I mean, really, reconnection and relationships and everything that we're talking about thematically here, and that both of us are interested in. The wisdom in this stuff tends to be rooted in paradox. This is what I keep discovering over and over again. Like, just an example or two might be like, we hit the end of our relationship. Like, we hit the very end. We hit with the last straw, the end of the rope, and we give up. And that's when our relationship might be reborn.
Right.
Might be reinvented. So there's a paradox in that, that to break through, we have to give up.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's a paradox that we might discover along the way.
And how did dilemma fit into this?
Thank you. Well, a dilemma is like an internal contradiction. So I might struggle with my own internal dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Two impulses that are at odds with one another. And I'm trying to find my way mm-hmm. through this dilemma. My dilemma might be like, do I spend money or save money? Do I stay? Do I go? Do I take this job? Do I not take this job? And then they might, a dilemma might run deeper, and not just be about necessarily like external life choices like that, but it might be like, do I show up in my emotional self or in my rational self?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really common kind of dilemma that runs under the surface and shows up in relationships a lot. And one of the reasons that this is important is because what I've discovered from witnessing so many relationships right down at their bones is that we all have to wrestle with our own dilemmas, with our own internal contradictions. And when our partner is taking a position, when they see us in this spot where we're struggling with our own inner contradiction, and then they take a position, one or the other, you should do this. Yesterday you said it was like this. Then we'll tend to project one side of this dilemma onto our partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then we no longer, that work that we have to do of struggling with our own dilemma gets cut short. And we've turned our partner into an adversary. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's well, I'll tell you what's coming up for me. I say yeah, but what comes up for me when you're speaking is my wife is amazing at just holding space. So if I have an internal dilemma, she gives me the space, she recognizes it, and she gives me the space to work through it. Whereas when she's got an internal contradiction or an internal conflict like that, she's going through her dilemmas, I'm not as good as holding space. And we're more likely for World War III to break out because I'm too busy trying to dive in there, trying to put it right. And I think part of that is anxiety, the anxiety that comes with being in an uncomfortable position where someone's struggling and I feel like I have the answer and I need help and I feel anxious and anxiety and negative emotions by not jumping in and help. But I also think there's a subconscious part of this where I'm actually trying to hurt her verbally, trying to gain an upper hand somehow.
Wow, that's a really useful insight.
Hmm.
I mean, when we can acknowledge our intent to hurt, that really opens some doors.
Yeah, I don't like that part of me, and it's something that I continually try to do the work to kind of cut away. It's like a it's like a nasty piece of meat with some, you know, some fat on that, like, it's just not edible. It just needs to be like moved out of the way. But that definitely happens, you know. And the other thing I've noticed as well is if there used to be a time in the past, whereas if my wife was to say something really hurtful to me, I would fly off the handle, you know, it would really increase my anger. These days when she says it, I know she doesn't mean it. And so I accept it, I tolerate it. And then later on, maybe 24 hours later, I'll say, hey, I want to remind you that really hurts me. Whereas in the past, I would have used it, let's just say, what's something that I don't like being accused? Let's say she says something like, I hate you, right? I've never hated anyone in my life, right? So she says, I hate you. In the past, Justice, I would have used that opportunity to now tip the argument in my favor by making her feel bad that she called me that, therefore giving me more authority to fire more daggers at her to take the vantage point in this fight and to win this fight. Because that's what my fights used to be about. I got to win this fight. Whereas now my conflicts are about, holy shit, this is getting out of control. How do I act right now to try to do my bit in this relationship to mitigate this conflict and to prevent it from escalating? And part of that is understanding that she's angry and that when a person is angry, they say things that they don't mean in a defensive way, and accepting that they don't mean it and that they are just angry and shit like this happens kind of really helps me.
Yeah.
I'm not perfect at it by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But and the reason I'm talking about this, Justin, of course, is there'll be hundreds of people listening to this right now who drink alcohol because of their conflict with their partners. Like they get in a conflict situation with a partner, It goes out of control. The volume starts going up. They start to lose it. They can't even remember what they were arguing about in the beginning. The whole world's got a fucking rat shit. And they slam doors, throw fists, and then they just go to the bar and get drunk, right? So I think conflict resolution and being aware of what's going on is really super important. And I know that's a long-winded answer, but that's kind of what come up for me when you're talking about dilemma.
Yeah, well, I can really relate to that that strategy of holding on to those hurtful words and then using them as a weapon or using them as evidence in the future. I mean, you can hold, when your partner says they hate you, I mean, you can hold on to that forever. You got it made. I mean, your partner told you that they hated you. If you want to pull that one out of your back pocket. But of course, as you've noticed, it gets old, and it doesn't really get you anywhere. And you've done the that mature work of acknowledging that that your wife has complicated feelings, and that when we lash out at each other in anger, it's not necessarily something that we want to stand by. She probably doesn't hate you 10 minutes later. And so there's a kind of initiation, I think, for couples when they go through those kinds of experiences. Because you lose your innocence. You confront this ideal that you had about, and I think most of us come into relationships with some ideal, like that our partner isn't going to tell us that they hate us, for one thing. And so when that is the reality of our relationship, or it's a part of the reality of our relationship, we have some difficult integrating work to do. Like, we have to make room for this thing that we didn't expect, and a part of our innocence dies. That's how I see it anyway. So to me, that's a kind of initiation where we drop that innocent idealism. And at that point, you know, we either turn against our partner and reject them. They're not the right one for us. They hate us. Clearly, this isn't real love. Or they turn against the idea of love itself. There's no such thing as love. It's all been an illusion. And so I like to steer towards love is complicated. Love is contradictory. Love is full of paradox. So here's a paradox. When your partner is able to tell you that they hate you in a moment of anger, and you're able to kind of let that go and not use that as ammunition against them, there's a possibility there for love to deepen. So that's pretty paradoxical, that love can deepen out of the experience of your partner telling you that they hate you.
Because it's another way of showing your partner that you accept their authentic self, good and bad. You know?
Yeah, there's room for their whole personhood in the relationship.
Yeah, I guess people get into this, hit this dead end where they really like these great attributes of their partner, but they fucking can't stand the bad bits, I know this is definitely, this has happened to me in both of my marriages, actually, where I've looked at my partner and I've really loved certain parts about them, but then there are parts that I haven't loved so much. So in my first marriage, for example, I didn't like the fact that my wife drank alcohol and what she became when she did drink. And of course, what I did is I tried to change that. And I guess what I've learned over time is once you get into this mode of trying to change the person you're with, then you've kind of lost respect for them and they will sense that. And they will divorce the shit out of you, which is what happened in my first marriage.
Yeah, there's a dance there, right? It's like there is negotiation to do in a marriage or a relationship. And it is legitimate to make requests and to wrestle with each other. But when we get into, I mean, it sounds like you know, like when you really became committed to the idea of changing your wife, and you get locked into that, and that kind of becomes your perspective, that becomes your position or your role. It really sets up the dynamic. And I haven't ever really seen that go in a direction that makes people happy.
No, I tell you what I used to do as well, and it wouldn't surprise me if I still do it sometimes, but nowhere near as frequent, is I would be very manipulative around how I was trying to change my partner, and then completely deny that I was doing that when it was thrust in front of me, and even to be as manipulative as to kind of make them feel bad for even presenting the theory. And although people listening to this might think, oh my God, what a monster, when I've kind of like had peace and calm and, you know, spent time thinking about this, it's all come from a subconscious level. And I'm not trying to dodge my responsibility, because I accept my responsibility and I accept the pain of the divorce that came with that responsibility. But I really don't believe, Justice, that I was in a room somewhere making and drawing up plans on a conscious level to destroy the integrity and the respect of my relationship. I just didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah, there's some unconscious impulse at work pulling the strings. Hmm. What you're describing is gaslighting, right?
I've never heard that term before.
So it's kind of a popular term. Maybe it's more American. It started popping up like around the last year or so a fair bit in my world. It relates to, it's taken from a movie 40s, I think, called Gaslighter. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's the story of a manipulator, a manipulative con artist who tricks a woman into thinking that she's crazy. In pretty much exactly the way that you've just outlined.
Yeah.
Manipulating and then denying. So she thinks, well, I must be crazy. And because this was a popular term over here, and I did the same kind of examining that you're talking about. And I came to a similar kind of conclusion, both in my own life and in my own relationships, most personally, but also in what I was seeing in my work, which is that it's mostly unconscious. So, I mean, this the story of the gaslighter is a very conscious con job, right? Mm. But there's a way that unconscious part of ourself that unconscious part of ourself pursues our agenda. If we've got an agenda to change our partner, then yeah, I think we do manipulate and deny and gaslight unconsciously. In fact, I wrote a piece about this exactly. It's exactly what you just described. Hmm. And, I called it shadow gaslighting.
Right.
Because what I kept finding was like, there was a lot of, I'd see a lot of accusation at the end of a relationship, especially, say, or toward the end. Accusation about how their partner manipulated and gaslit them. Hmm. so like get, the gaslighter is sort of like, you know, these days everybody's accusing their partners of being narcissists. I don't know if that's the true in your world, but I see a lot of that. So gaslighter kind of became the new narcissist. And the part that got missed, I thought, was that this isn't planned. This is mostly the unconscious at work, which, like you say, it's not an excuse exactly. It's not like you're skipping, bless you, your responsibility in this, but I think it's really important to acknowledge that, yeah, our unconscious runs the show in our relationships, especially. So
I think
let's make sure we keep looking at that.
I think one of the reasons it's really important is, I think I read in your book that you touched upon the fact, I don't know if it's a statistical fact or an opinion, that, you know, it's more likely that women are going to go to counseling than men, or the women are more likely to drag the men to counseling than, you know, than the other way around. I think that one of the problems here is when I use words like manipulate, and I sit down in front of my wife and say, holy shit, I manipulate you, I cannot think of a stronger word right now which makes me sick to my core. Like, if I don't like to be manipulated myself. I abhor it. I was on a sales call with a woman yesterday who was manipulating me, and I wanted to put my head through a wall. So I guess what I'm getting at is, I think largely it's going to be maybe the men who are doing the manipulating here. So I'm kind of brainstorming out loud. Wouldn't this therefore then prevent them from even acknowledging it because it's such a bad thing? It's like having, I don't know, it's like having sexual fantasies about banging your mum. It's like you're never going to talk about them because it's like, you don't want to be associated with them. So you pretend shit like that never happens. And it's the same, like, I don't want to be manipulated, be deemed manipulative. So I will forget that that thought even came in my mind. And because you forget it and repress it and don't deal with it, you just continue to be a manipulator. Does that make sense?
Right. Oh, yeah, I think it does. And it reminds me, I feel like a part of my role in the work that I do through my writing and working with clients is I try and normalize that stuff. So if someone has the courage to confront their own manipulativeness in their relationship or their punishing or their cruelty, I really welcome that. And first and foremost, I want to normalize it. It's like, yeah, that's what we do. Yes, welcome.
Yeah, I guess the guy's kind of sorry, this cough. I guess the guys are worrying if I tell my partner that I'm manipulative, that they'll leave me because they don't want to be with anyone who's manipulative. But in fact, I think the reverse is true. They'll see you being vulnerable and that gives them the hope that you are willing to take a look at your own shit and change. Like, I don't believe we should be trying to change our partner. Like, I don't want my partner to change me. But if she points out a part of my behavior which is not helping our relationship, that needs to be changed. And I think there are two distinctly different things, you know? And I think the more that men can listen to podcasts like this and think to themselves, oh, okay, being a manipulative son of a bitch is a subconscious and a normal thing that kind of probably happens to a lot of people in the world. I think it can really help them to, it can only do good things in relationships. Another thing come up that I want to ask you about, which I think...
Let me speak to that a little bit.
Sure,
is that
all right? Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because I think it's such, I think you're so insightful on this, and everything you're saying just matches my experience and my observations so well. I'm not convinced that there's a big difference between men and women in that regard, in terms of like admitting one's manipulation, for example, or confronting one's own like semi-conscious strategies for pressuring our partner or whatever. But there might be some differences, and I really like what you said about this fear that if we reveal our manipulativeness or our cruelty or our will to hurt, like you just did a few minutes ago, that our partner is going to bristle and say, "Well, that's a deal breaker for me. I'm not going to be with someone who's manipulative or cruel or willfully hurtful." And I've seen this in my sessions, and I've seen it in both directions. I've seen both men and women shocked to hear their partner's revelation in this regard, and I've witnessed that, that dilemma. Do I tolerate this? Because we're fed an ideal about relationships that certainly doesn't include those qualities. And then you mentioned that it's probably better to put this stuff on the table and acknowledge it with your partner, and probably that makes your partner actually feel safer or more more respected. And I think the truth is we don't necessarily know how someone is going to respond to that information. It's risky. It's risky to reveal our hurtful intent or our cruelty or our manipulativeness, even when we're revealing it in that context of, hey, here's a thing I notice I kind of do semi-consciously, and I want to examine it, and I want to change it, and I just want to put it on the table so that it's like a thing we can actually talk. And I've been that, you know, I've been that guy for sure.
is there another issue here, actually, a deeper issue, in as much as I'm often guilty of thinking the world works in accordance with my worldview. So I'll be really careful about how I put this, okay? In my sphere of influence of life, so the people and the relationships who I've come into contact with throughout my life, so that would be my friends and my family, when I talk like this, like I'm talking to you now with my friends, particularly the male friends, so my father or my brother-in-laws or my friends, they think I'm fucking nuts. And when I tell them I'm thinking about talking to Liza about the fact that I'm manipulative, or that I saw a woman walk down the street the other day and she had really great legs and I'm a bit confused about why I'm doing it. When I talk about these things with these people, their answer is generally, Lee, you talk too much. There are certain things you just should not say to your missus. You should just leave it. And I'm always left thinking that people don't deal with shit or don't hire justice until the relationship is hanging by a thread. And if they did work with people like you, not because they felt they had to because their relationship was failing, but instead as a fun, intimate, positive thing that you engaged as a couple to strengthen your relationship, then I think people would be more willing to turn around and have these conversations, put them on the table. I'm worried that what happens a lot is that none of these things ever go on the table because couples are just too busy watching fucking Netflix and sitting in silence, not even touching or talking or looking at each other. So these things don't get spoken about. They then fester and then boom, fuck it. They have a drink World War Five escalates, things get broken, smashed, and more drinks are consumed, and it just, this vicious cycle just keeps circulating, because of course nobody's even going to talk about it. You kiss and make up, you have the makeup sex the next day, it's great, wonderful, you eat a kebab and you're back to normal, right? Have you seen that in your line of work?
What you've just described is you've given a very accurate description, and I love the vision of entering into these dialogues and these explorations in a sense of fun and curiosity and excitement and growth and eroticism and intimacy. But that's rare. These are the rare people. I used to think a lot like, oh boy, if people would come a little sooner. And I don't love the terminology around like communication skills and stuff. It just leaves me a bit cold. But if people could find the enjoyment, the liveliness in digging a little together, in revealing something unusual or extraordinary. I think relationships would look a lot different. And my work would look a lot different. But then at the same time, I acknowledge that it takes, people are busy, and it's a cliche, so the other part I'll add to that great description that you just gave is that when they do come, they want their life, they want their relationship back to some semblance of normal, either from their memory, their history, or their fantasy.
Yeah.
They've got an idea of back to normal. And so that's one of the interesting kind of obstacles that we need to work with, because that is highly unlikely. It's highly unlikely that you get to the point where you hire me and then get your relationship back to normal. Something is gonna be profoundly changed. And I think that's frightening. Because you have no idea, you hang out with your guy friends and they think you're crazy. So where do we get the social structures and the encouragement and just the venue for laying it out on the table and taking risks? And to me, that's actually the root of intimacy. I talk about that in the book a little bit, about what intimacy actually is. And it's a kind of a mysterious thing. And it's a thing that many people want more of, not everybody.
Well, when I went to Burning Man two summers ago, I didn't deliberately go to do this, but it kind of manifested itself over the time I was there. I did a lot of work about being intimate with men, and it just happened organically. I didn't plan on it, and I just realized that was the part of a healing process that I needed to do there. Not for any reason. I couldn't. There's no, history of trauma related to men in my life or anything like that. But back in the day when I was a drinker, if someone would have said the word intimate to me, it would have meant fucking. And so if someone would have said to me they need to work on being intimate with men, I'd be like, what, you want to fucking have a man? Like, I would not have been able to wrap my head around it. And what I want to talk to listeners about right now is, when I was a drinker, I never philosophized like this. I was never interested in digging around why I did the things I did, or why I lived the life I did. I was just a machine on automatic pilot heading for destination fuck knows where, right? And when I quit drinking alcohol, white space appeared in front of me, activities. I had time for activities because I wasn't drinking anymore. But also white space appeared in my mind because my mind wasn't consumed with the thoughts of drinking alcohol, right? And that's when I started to think. And that's when I started to find that I was scared of it at first. But the more and the reason I was scared of it was the people I was around at the time, my sphere of influence at the time, they would try to repress my new me because they were scared that I was changing so much that they would lose me, right? So what I had to do, and I want people to really think about this, and it isn't easy, it's one of the most difficult things you'll ever face in your life, is if you're in a relationship, doesn't matter what relationship it is, and you have to repress who you are at a deep, authentic level, you're not allowed to speak or say what you want and have that space held for you, you've got to find people who will hold that space for you. I am talking divorces. I am talking separating yourself and giving some distance between you and your family members. Because you have to do that. Otherwise, you're just going to end up on your deathbed looking back thinking, I fucked that up.
Yeah, if you're lucky, you get that at the end. And I agree, like that's an important bottom line. If you can't, and this is again, this, I mean, I've got a couple of I try and meet people where they're at in this work, and without imposing a lot of my own principles. But one of my principles that I hold on to pretty tight is that we have to be able to be ourselves in relationship. That's fundamental. And that's the lens that I bring to every couple that I work with. So there's always a part of me that's going, yeah, are these people able to be themselves? Fully be themselves? Is there room for both of these people in this relationship? And if not, like, what's getting exiled here? And what do we do about it?
Can I ask
you? And then you bring it back to booze. This is your like life and your work, right? Alcohol and how that factors in. Yeah, it's illuminating to hear your experience and perspective on that. I mean, I've got some experience with it, but it obviously hasn't impacted me the same way that it's impacted you. And yet I do think about it. I see the impact that alcohol has on some relationships and on some people. Yeah, in all sorts of ways. So maybe we'll talk about that some more.
Let's see if we can dig out some advice out of this then, because I've got something particular I want to ask you about what you just talked about. One of the greatest fears of men and women, I guess, is being locked up in prison. Can you imagine going to jail for 30, 40 years and just seeing those four walls every day? Like, it's a fear that people have, right? But I actually think that what's even worse than that is being stuck in a prison in a relationship and actually watching life go on around you and you still cannot break free of this confinement. And what I see in my work is a lot of women in particular, a lot of women who cannot be themselves. They cannot be themselves, right? And they can't be themselves because they've sacrificed so much of their life to their children and their husbands that by the time they get to like 50, 60, and they think that they are, okay, I really need to figure this out and be who I am. I deserve to be who I am. They've actually lost the ability to live. They don't know how to take care of themselves anymore. They don't look after money. They don't have any money because their husband does all the work and they've just looked after the kids. They don't know how to look after a house on their own. They're afraid they will never meet somebody ever again because they don't believe they're sexually appealing anymore because they've just been with this one person an entire life, you know? And how can we, and this is particularly so if the woman has just decided to give up drinking and the guy is not quitting, how can that person, and let's make this even more realistic and bring my life into this. So let's just say, and the guy who is not quitting drinking is also manipulative. And every time she tries to confront these issues, he just dominates her verbally. He might even dominate her physically. Okay. So he can just keep the peace. What advice are we giving to that woman who is just paralyzed here, Justice, and really doesn't know what to do? Did I just give you a really easy question?
No. You know, I don't give a lot of advice. I'm stingy with advice for this reason. It's that I don't know any formula for this. And so, I mean, a person like this, well, you're painting a picture here of a woman. A woman in this situation probably needs some a place for expression. There's probably a lot to be expressed through the body, through tears or rage or art or dance or movement or pounding, or what you're describing is a suppression. I feel in this scenario that you've painted here, there's this sense of numbness, of suppression, of being a passive observer. And probably, you know, at the juncture that you're describing in this life, there's probably a great deal of pent-up impulse. That suppression wants to give way to some sort of expression. So I don't know if I have advice exactly, but if I knew a person like this, I would probably look for opportunities to support their expression in all those kind of different ways that I mentioned and more. And especially, you know, when you add the alcohol part, so if she's quit drinking, I mean, I think you'll know more about, you'll have thought about this a lot more than me, but I think that one of the appeals of alcohol is that it gives us an opportunity to be expressive. It removes some inhibition, right? I think that's a pretty common view of alcohol. And we need expressiveness, and many of us live in culturally imposed or self-imposed kind of suppression. And alcohol is one of those largely socially acceptable ways to express, and then we can kind of put it all away at the end of the night and go back to our normal life, whether we get drunk and let someone know how much we hate them or how much rage we have in us, or we express our love or our sexuality, or the part of us that we have to repress for whatever reason can sometimes be expressed with alcohol. So I imagine for someone who stops using alcohol, that could get really jammed up. I'm just kind of extrapolating here with the scene you've set.
No, you hit the nail on the head. I think there's a big difference between someone sober in a relationship just all of a sudden piping up with all these kind of things that they have on their mind that they haven't talked about for a long time, compared to someone who's drunk doing it. I think the partner would give more leniency to the drunk person doing it because they can just pass it off as, Sheila was drunk yesterday. You know, it's like it's almost acceptable because it's not them, it's their alter ego, the drunk them. You were right in as much as alcohol allows people, you know, to drop their inhibitions and all that pent up frustration comes out. I don't want people listening to this to think that that's a good thing, though, because there's nothing worse than your inhibitions dropping when you don't have control over those inhibitions dropping. And this is one of the primary reasons why accident and emergency rooms are full on the weekend of women and men who need to be looked after, because it just, these loss of inhibitions and this pent up frustration because we're not able to be ourselves escalates into violence, escalates into a mess. I like what you said about expression. I guess in a relationship, when you're in a relationship and you're thinking to yourself, I want a better relationship. I want more out of this relationship, that you could maybe forget that you could actually just go out and express yourself individually. And I do see people in my community doing that eventually, almost like losing patience with their partner and kind of saying, okay, all right, if you're not going to come salsa dancing with me, I'm going to go on my own, right? Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. they go, and then they start dancing and they feel alive. And holy shit, now they feel alive, right? They've mm-hmm. got the bug. So now they want more of this aliveness. And I think I read it in your book that there was an example of a couple who went to see you, and one of the women just did one thing. I can't even remember what it was. It might have been something as simple as just going to the movies or something. And they suddenly felt alive and went back to their husband and said, right, I don't want to be with you anymore. You know? Mm-hmm. So I guess, particularly with alcohol, once you, let's say you've quit drinking and your husband hasn't, you can't change him. He doesn't want to stop drinking. He's belittling you. He's trying to manipulate you into drinking again because he wants your drinking buddy back. And you decide that you're going to join the Needy Helper, join our forum. You start going to meetups with sober people. You start going on mountain climbs. You start going to salsa lessons. And all the time you're doing this, I think you just need to be aware that is a really good thing, that you find an expression. But also you've got this monster at home kind of boiling slowly, scared out of his wits that he's going to lose you. And he really doesn't know how to deal with that. And it will probably, I don't know, the outcome won't be very good. He probably won't have the skills to deal with it. And it would just end up in more arguments, debates and issues. And if that happens, I really suggest that you get older people like Justice and you bring some expertise in, because I didn't have a clue, and I still don't have a clue majority of the time. We really need help. Let me ask you a question, Justice. With all the work you do and all the people that come and see you, do you ever, ever sit there in front of the mirror, shaving, thinking, men and women just aren't meant to be together?
I never think that, but I certainly contemplate the inherent tension. So some of the words that people use when they describe the relationship they want is peace. I want peace. I want understanding. I want and some and they're these like they're great words and a part of me thinks, okay, well, you better make room also for the irreconcilable tension between men and women. And I've come to trust. I think that tension can take a lot of different forms. And I think that we consciously and unconsciously and individually and socially, we try to engineer our way out of that tension. And sometimes I think we might be a little too optimistic in our cleverness or our influence or our power, and that there's probably some value in just like facing that tension as it is, as it shows up. And working with it more directly rather than seeing it. Well, this comes back to that kind of that normalizing. It's like people will, a couple will come in and they'll think there's something terribly wrong with them or their relationship because they're not getting it right, because they're experiencing conflict, because that tension is so palpable. And certainly it ebbs and flows, and certainly it's not going to be tolerable in every relationship, and some personalities bring out some versions of it that are just not going to be acceptable to some people, and all that is part of the journey, I guess. But that tension is also a source of energy. I guess that's another part of it. So, and that could take us down a whole other kind of rabbit hole. I think clearly men and women are meant to be together. And it's not supposed to be smooth sailing necessarily.
I think that's something happened in my relationship the other day, which is unusual because of my rational way of looking at the world. And my wife's very emotional way of looking at the world, again, something that you covered in the book. We had an argument, and it was what was different about this argument was we didn't make up. One of us, I think it was me, just asked for distance, a bit like your talking stick, but without the talking stick. I just said, I just need to be alone. And we never came back to it. And we never talked about it. Now, what was different about this was we didn't ignore it because we were trying to not deal with it and repress it and kind of brush it under the carpet. We didn't deal with it because we both acknowledged that fighting is a part of love. And I think that was a huge moment in our relationship because I think I piss my wife off something terrible by trying to talk and find the root cause into every single little squabble and argument. And I'm beginning to realize that whilst there's a place for that sometimes, there's also a place to just let it go. And I think, are we talking about dark love here, Justice?
I don't know. Say more.
So everything we've been talking about right now, I think it's making me think about conditioning. So I have a belief that I have a conviction that the reason people drink alcohol is because we've been conditioned to drink it since birth. And once we realize that and we look at that through a different set of spectacles, we can remove the desire to drink. I also believe that we've been conditioned, most of us have been conditioned to believe that love is something airy fairy, nice, beautiful, princess and prince lives happily ever after. I even think that in relationships where children have seen their parents like go to war, I still think that they are conditioned by the 5,000 images a day that are bombarding them from marketing that love is beautiful. But love isn't all that. Love is as dark as it is light. And I think once we can, you talked about normal. Like someone said to me the other day when I was working with them, I want to be normal. I mean, what the fuck does that mean that anyway for people? And the fact that we're even thinking about it, I think is sad. You know, and I relate it to love. I think we have these views that are just not right. And if we can just accept that they're not right and to look at love and think, actually, having conflict and navigating it and dealing with it and frustrations and fights, it's all part of love. It's all part of a relationship.
Well, I can certainly agree with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an important part. And the friction, I mean, there's all sorts of lovely cliches about this stuff, right?
Mm.
The friction is it's important. It's how we, like, growth isn't comfortable entirely, right? Mm. And it never I imagine it never has been for people. We walk upright and we have spines because of the friction that gravity has given us. And our fighting against gravity has given us all sorts of gifts along the way over these millions of years of evolution. And maybe the friction in our relationships can be valuable in similar ways. It keeps pushing us to examine and explore and meet each other and see from other perspectives and hold multiple truths. But that doesn't come easily for us.
No.
Largely because of what you've pointed out. We're handed a script about alcohol and the role that it has in our lives. We're handed a script about relationships and love and what that's supposed to look like. And it's a very painful and disorienting process to watch that disintegrate in our lives and to try to build something, embrace something, live something, just as it is, just as it really presents itself.
Yeah, well, as you...
I find it wildly disorienting.
Hmm.
I've been there and continue to go there myself, and I see it. I mean, I have a lot of compassion for people that step off that edge.
Hmm.
That edge of what they believed their relationship was supposed to be and into the void of what it actually is. I mean, that's a huge leap. It's a huge step. Hmm. We fight so hard to prop up our projection and fantasy.
Hmm.
And one of the paradoxes is that when we take that step, it's a risky place to be because relationships don't always survive that. And if all we're trying to do is protect the relationship, we're not going to take that step. We have to be willing to risk the relationship at a certain point, I think.
Yeah, I think what I learned about going through divorce is it kind of destroys the myth that you need to find a partner and live with them forever. I got to examine the fact that we go through many changes through our life. It reminded me of a book by Eric Ries called The Lean Startup, where he talks about businesses that go down, you know, they try an experiment and they try this different approach. And at some point they need to ask the question, when it's not working, do we persevere or do we pivot? And when you persevere, you keep going, but you try to do some tweaks. But when you pivot, you're taking a whole new different approach. And I don't think we are meant to find a partner when we're 14 and live with them until we're 100. I think we're meant to change a lot. And when we do change, if we can't find acceptance in that change from the people who we are looking for it for, or indeed we actually change so much that we want someone else in our life, then as taboo as those things are, we have to confront that is reality out there. Equally though, I also think that you should fight as much as you can to try to make things work, particularly if you have children. And that's like, I had a 10-year-old boy when I was going through my divorce, and I'm don't have any regrets about being divorced. It was the thing that needed to happen. However, I do think that I should have, even though it would have been a fruitless task, I should have tried more for the sake of my boy. But there you are. I want to spend the last 10, 15 minutes, if that's okay, if you've got that time, Justice.
Yeah, this is fun.
I want to touch about sex because it's, again, it's one of those taboo topics that people don't generally talk about.
Even people who are having sex with each other.
yeah, almost definitely.
And, especially those people.
Yeah. And especially, I believe that in the bedroom and sex, it can, how the sex is can manifest itself in a variety of different ways in the relationship. And I wanted to talk about something that came up for me that was an epiphany when I read your book. And that was the question, what does sex mean to you? And I want everybody listening to this, by the way, and we'll put it in the show notes, to buy Justice's book, okay? Is that good? And you can find this question there and ask yourself it. But what came up for me was, I'm 42 now, Justice, and I've only just realized at 42 that sex, for me, has always been about reaching orgasm.
Okay.
So much so that I've joked in my writing that sex is nothing but a lot of huffing and puffing until you get to where you want to get to. But if you stop joking for a minute and you consider the impact that has on a relationship with the person who's lying beneath you, I was quite mortified by that. I realized that I used women as a vehicle for my own release, and I'm so preoccupied with getting to orgasm, I'm not even there.
Yeah, it's hard to know what the alternative might be or what it might look like or what else might be available.
Well, I spoke to my wife. I think you called it the tyranny of orgasm. I love that. And I spoke to my wife about it, and she's like, yeah, I know. That was the first thing. Yeah, I know you're not there. I know you're not there. I know we don't have intimacy. I know you're using me. I know you're just interested in orgasm. But I say it's an epiphany because sometimes we're looking for this complicated answer when the simplicity is, the answer is simple. And the answer in this case for me is stop caring about orgasm. Now, you would have been, okay, I shouldn't have said that. Okay. I'm imagining a lot of people listening to this may have been in this situation. Okay. So I'm going to give a situation. Let's say I have a 6-month-old baby. right? So let's say my wife and I start having sex later on and the baby cries in the middle of it, okay? It is, for the woman, in my experience, that's just the end of sex. The baby's just woke up, needs to be dealt with. That's the end of sex. It might continue later on, but it's kind of the end for now, right? But I'm there with an hard on thinking, well, I need to come. Either you're going to have to help me do this or I'm going to do this myself. But the thought of me just ending there in the middle of it without that release is unthinkable. It's like an alcoholic buying a bottle of wine and leaving half of it because he's not thirsty anymore.
Right.
So the answer is, next time I have sex with my wife, I ain't thinking about the orgasm. I don't care about the orgasm. I don't want to get to orgasm. I just want to see what happens when I think like that. And what I think is going to happen is I'm going to be present. And she'll feel that. And can you imagine the difference between feeling that your partner's present compared to knowing you're not there? Like, have we ever wondered as men why our partners don't want to have sex with us? It's not that they don't like sex. It's because there's no desire to want to do it if you are behaving the way that I have been behaving. So I guess I just wanted to thank you for that. I wanted to share it because if people are listening, they might be having bedroom troubles, Justice, and that could be contributing to this whole alcohol thing and this all my relationship is terrible.
But I think sexual frustration is a huge one.
But the guy might not even be aware of it, is what I'm saying.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
Part of that we don't really talk
about it. It's one of those taboos. I think we many people are so sexually frustrated and so accustomed to that being normal that it doesn't even occur to them that there's an alternative.
Well, we're back to what we were talking earlier on about openly admitting that you're being manipulative. But this is a million times worse. Like, how many guys are going to sit down with their wife and say, someone I want to tell you, I've been using you for the past 30 years and all I'm interested in is having an orgasm. I couldn't give a fuck what happens to you. And even when I give you an orgasm first, the only reason I'm doing it is because I get that out of the way and now I can concentrate on mine. Those conversations are just not going to happen, are they? But I think if someone listening to this can realize that it happens, then maybe there's a chance.
Yeah. And if you want to move in that direction, because it opens a lot of doors when we drop our orgasm focus. And I think it happens for women too, by the way. Many women are very orgasm focused.
Ah, right.
It's not exclusive to men. When we drop that focus, we welcome the possibility of all sorts of other kinds of sex. And not just like different kinds of positions or time frames, but different kinds of sexual experiences. Mm-hmm. You use the word presence. That's a good word. And I think, talking about it with your partner, you did that and you got some immediate agreement. Yep, that's what you do. That's right.
Yeah, there was an apology there as well. And it brought a tear. It made my wife cry because it was I think she was hoping that it would happen one day, that I'd fucking wake up. And in the, we check in, all right, we don't check in nightly anymore since we've had the baby, but we used to check in nightly. And she said to me not long after I'd read your book, a couple of days after I'd read your book, when we were checking in, I feel in a really good place with us right now. I feel like opening myself up to you. I feel like feel so much closer to you. And that wasn't a coincidence. That was because I read your book and I realized that I needed to change some of the ways that I was behaving and to apologize and to be more vulnerable and to share my learning from that book. Even just sharing your learning from that book is a statement that you're willing to work on your relationship. And that is beautiful for the person for the person who has been waiting to hear that for so long. And for some people, it could be 50 years.
It's true. Good for you for having that conversation. And one of the things that that does is it opens the door to intimacy. Your wife was moved, obviously, and you revealed something of yourself. And, you know, we didn't get to talk much about intimacy specifically, but maybe we'll do that another time. But there's a lot of opportunities around practicing different kinds of sex that aren't orgasm focused, for instance, and having the conversation that you just had. Well, these are intimacy opportunities.
Well, you talked earlier on, didn't you, about when I give you that really difficult scenario about the woman being trapped in the prison of her own relationship, and you said you didn't like to give advice, but you talked about if somebody were to come in front of you like that, you would talk about expression, right? And we talked about the difference between expressing as a couple and expressing individually and going out and doing things on your own, like salsa dancing, etc. What wonderful, right. What wonderful way of expression than sex, because sex leads to intimacy. If you're more intimate with your partner, you're more likely to be more vulnerable. Therefore, you're more likely to share what's going on for you because you feel like you trust the person to hold space for you while you do that, which means you're less likely to have pent up frustrations, which means you're less likely to have conflicts that you cannot control and navigate around, which means you're less likely to want to drink because you don't need to numb or lose your inhibitions because you feel more comfortable in your relationship. And I think what we talked about here for the last 19 minutes is just a way of a being and lots of different ways of being authentic and allowing authenticity to blossom in your relationship, because it creates such a wonderful opportunity to have a wonderful life and a life free of alcohol, you know?
Sounds good.
I think I'm going to leave now and write a book called The Tyranny of Orgasm.
Oh, please do. I look forward to reading it.
I'm going to patent it. Justice, thank you immensely for being on the podcast. I apologize for people for my coughing. I canceled two podcasts yesterday. I didn't want to cancel a third one, so I hope it didn't affect your enjoyment. Justice, I want to thank you for writing a beautiful book, a very different book. I read a lot of books, and I lost count of the number of books I start reading and I don't finish because they just fucking bore me these days. Everybody's writing the same shit. Yours is very different. So I really want to thank you for that. I also want to thank you for helping me on this podcast by being calm and bringing a peace to the discussion, because I'm very uncomfortable with silences and you're not. And I learned to deal with a few today, and I could feel my heart going, and I felt like I had a little mini lesson in there somewhere. So please keep in touch, and I will put all your contacts information below in the show notes. And I encourage everybody who's listening to this, two things. One, buy Justice's book. Two, join his 8-week training course. Do not wait until the shit hits the fan in order to seek help. Think of this as expression. Think of working with justice as a good way of expression, of enjoyment, of discovery, of philosophy. Please do that, because I'm telling you, your relationship will reap the rewards of it.
You're a very good host, and I've really enjoyed this conversation, so I hope you'll invite me back.
Justice, unfortunately, I have this thing in my head where I never, ever want to interview someone twice on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
But we will definitely do other things together in the future, yes, because there's so much more to talk about in different formats. Or maybe one day I'll break my rule. Who knows?
Well, let me know what suits you.
Yeah. But, hey, here you are.
It's not a bad rule.
I've reached out to you, Justice. I want to tell everyone, I've reached out to you, haven't I? And I want to do work with you, and I'm hoping to do work with you in the future, because I believe that you can help me, guide me through a lot of things that are going through my mind, not in just relationships, but how I can become a better host of this podcast, how I can become a better coach to the people who are looking to me for inspiration to help them quit alcohol. When I read your book, I was like, this guy can help me be a better person for these people who are looking for me for help. So, yeah, without a shadow of doubt, we'll definitely keep in touch, and I'll share back with the community about how that work's doing.
Thank you.
Take care, buddy.
Thanks, Lee. Bye for now.